Hi, folks. Welcome to the Smart Ass Historian. I am, as always, the Great White Snark, Scotty J. Seated to my right is the Reverend Jeff.
How's it going?
You saw recently that John Witherspoon died.
Yeah. That sucks, man.
I know.
I'm fucking losing everybody. Last couple of years, it's just like, man.
Well, what was...
We're losing all our comedians, all our, you know, favorite... Right. Singers and songwriters.
Well, there was one night my brother made some burgers for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And he made some big-ass burgers.
Some mama burgers?
No, it wasn't no green pepper welfare mama burgers. But, I mean, he put in like some seasoning and everything and mixed it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting there eating like, man, these are some good-ass burgers, man. We should do a burger truck. Or, you know, we were talking about doing a restaurant. We were going to call it Brothers Big Ass Burgers. And we already came up with our commercial.
Brothers, not brothers.
Yeah, brothers. We're like, are you tired of burger places down the street where they give you more bun than they give you meat? Come on down to Brothers Big Ass Burgers. Burger so big, make you want to smack your mama. Yeah, boy. I had to tell him about Boondocks because, you know, John Witherspoon was the voice of Granddad on the Boondocks cartoon.
I never liked that cartoon.
Oh, that cartoon was hilarious. I loved it. I think I loved it more for the fact that John Witherspoon basically was playing himself.
Yeah.
He was basically playing himself as Granddad. Because, like, all the stuff he was saying as Granddad, you could see him saying as, like, Craig's dad on a Friday's film.
Yeah.
Like the episode where he was dating a whore, and the boys were like, Granddad, does she keep asking you if you're a cop? And the girl would come up and she'd be like, you know, you'd have to tell you you're a cop or that's entrapment. Can she run really fast in high heel shoes?
Yeah.
Does she duck under the table every time a man in a purple suit walks past?
Yeah, never shit.
But, yeah, we were, you know, and my brother's got all the Friday movies, so we one night we watched Friday After Next, the Christmas one, just to get some John Witherspoon going on.
Yeah, no shit.
Oh, we got a good show today. And this one came about partly because I was out of something I read in, Revolutionary Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
It was about Alexander Hamilton, and everyone's like, "You're just doing that because the musical's so popular." Well, no.
We haven't even seen the musical. I haven't seen it.
My cousin.
I mean, I would like to, but.
Right, my cousin. She took her family to go see it. I'm like, I can tell you how it ends.
Yeah.
He gets shot.
Yeah, no shit.
But Hamilton is an interesting story. So he was born in Charlestown on the island of Nevis, down there in the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
on January 11th. But we're not sure if it was 1755 or 1757. On that date in one of those 2 years, you know?
Yeah.
Now, him and his brother James Jr. were born out of wedlock to their mother Rachel Fawcett, who was married to James Hamilton Sr., and we're not sure if his mother was of mixed race or not, but she is listed as white on the tax records. Mama was hoeing!
Yeah. White on the tax records.
Yeah. Yeah, if you were a light enough skin tone where you get passed for white,
mm-hmm.
then they marked you white on the tax records. If it was obvious, they'd go mulatto.
Yeah.
Now, the difference in the birth year has been debated for pretty much since he was born. Some say Hamilton lowered his age to fit in with his college peers, while other documents suggest he was older than what he claimed. Most historians now agree that 1755 is most likely the actual year.
Yeah,
because, you know, you kind of sit there and go, okay, well, if he was at this age in this particular year, then that means he was born, you know, at this time period. Sometimes I do that when I'm, you know, like, talking about people in the Civil War. Because people are like, well, how old was such and such? I'm like, well, considering that they were probably 40 around the time of the war, most of them were 1820s. Now, Hamilton's mother had been married previously to Johann Michael Levine, a Danish or German merchant, we're not exactly sure, on the island of St. Croix in the Virgin Islands. Yes,
I am. My name is Johnny Wishwood. I'm from the island of St. Croix.
I was just thinking about that.
Just a sing on Johnny Wishwood and I'll be on my way.
I was just thinking about that.
I'll come a running.
Your name is Lutz.
Yeah. Biddle. It's like Kibbles and Bits, only different. Lutz and Biddle.
Now, St. Croix at the time, or the Virgin Islands in general, they were ruled by Denmark. Now, they had a son, Peter Levine, and in 1750, Fawcett left her husband and her first son, then traveled to St. Kitts, where she met James Hamilton. Hamilton and Fawcett moved together to Nevis, which was her birthplace, where she had inherited a seaside lot in the town from her father.
Whoa.
Uh-huh.
Swanky.
You know, you kind of inherited some land. You're like, hey, how'd you like to sail your ship into my port? I got some land. Well, let's go.
Yeah.
Now, James Hamilton later abandoned Rachel and their two sons, James Jr. and Alexander, allegedly to spare her a charge of bigamy, after finding out that her first husband intended to divorce her under Danish law on grounds of adultery and desertion.
What the hell?
Honey, I know you're not divorced, but I'm going to leave your ass just to save you from being called a whore.
Yeah.
But although you are a whore,
yeah,
I'm going to spare you that indignation. Mighty white of you.
Yeah, I'm divorcing you because you're a whore, but I don't want to call you a whore.
Well, they weren't married since she was still married to her first husband.
Oh, okay.
They was just shacking up.
Oh, they were just shacking up.
Yeah, they were shacking up. He gives her two sons, and he goes, wait, you're not married? You're still married? Well, I don't want you to be called a whore, so I'm going to leave.
I'm going to leave now.
You're right. So thereafter, Rachel moved with her two children to St. Croix, where she
said, I can't be with you because you're a whore.
I love you and all, but you're a whore, baby. Okay, so she moved the children to St. Croix, where she supported them by keeping a small store in Christiansted. Well, she contracted yellow fever and died on February 19th, 1768, at 1:02 in the morning, leaving young Alexander orphaned.
Bam.
Now, this may have had severe... You don't think? This may have had severe emotional consequences for him, even by the standards of an 18th century childhood.
You think?
Right. It's like, okay, even by our standards, that's fucked up.
Yeah, but it seemed like it probably helped him.
Yeah, I mean, look what he did later in life.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Now, oh, I fucking bumped it, man. Bumped the table and a lot. Okay, so, now in probate court, her first husband seized her estate and obtained the few valuables that she owned, including some of the household silver. Many of the items were auctioned off, but a friend purchased the family's books and gave them the Alexander. Like, here, kid, we know your mom had these books. And I know, and you know, it sucks that everything's getting sold off. But here's your mama's books. Have fun. So after her death, Hamilton became a clerk at the import-export firm of Beekman and Kruger. One. There was a man running loose on St. Croix.
Yeah, I don't know. I just...
Trying to understand his upbringing a little bit?
Yeah, I'm trying to understand him
okay.
more.
Well, you're right. Now, Hamilton and his brother moved in with their cousin, Peter Lytton, but in July of 1769, Peter committed suicide and the brothers were separated since he left his property to his mistress and their son.
Oh, shit.
It just seems like bad luck just keeps happening. So James became an apprentice of a carpenter, while a merchant named Thomas Stevens took in Alexander. Now, some clues we have led to speculating that Stevens may have been Alexander's biological father. His son Edward Stevens became a close friend, and the two boys were described as looking much alike. Both were fluent in French and shared similar interests. So, if this is the case, then Mom was stepping out on Hamilton.
But you know someone else has got to die.
Right.
So, here it comes.
However, this allegation, mostly based on the documents of Timothy Pickering on the resemblance between the two men, have always been vague and unsupported. Now, Rachel had been living on St. Kitts and Nevis for years at the time when Alex was conceived, while Thomas lived on Antigua and St. Croix also, and James Hamilton never disclaimed paternity. Even in later years, signed his letters to Hamilton with, "Your very affectionate father."
Hmm.
Oh, father. Now, Hamilton proved to be an adept trader and was often left alone to run the shop while Thomas was out. Hamilton became an avid reader and loved to write in his spare time. But, as many young men, he began to dream of a life away from the island. Now, Hamilton and his brother applied to the Church of England for admittance into their school, but since their parents were not married, they were denied.
Oh, shit.
Your sons of whores, literally, they can't get in. Both boys were tutored in a private school ran by a Jewish headmistress, and Hamilton supplemented his education by reading the 34 books in the family library. So in October of 1772, Hamilton arrived in Boston and made his way to New York City, where he stayed with a brother of a trader who helped him sell some cargo to pay for his education. Now, before he went off to college, he filled in his educational gaps at the Elizabethtown Academy. It was here that he met and was influenced by William Livingston, who was a leading intellectual and revolutionary. As I say, man, you go to college and you meet all these radicals.
Yep.
Didn't happen to me because I was teaching, you know, the next generation.
Not too much anymore, though.
No.
The radicals really aren't.
No, most of the radicals are in old folks' home because, you know...
Well, I'm just saying, you go to a college campus these days, and it's like, yeah, you get a bunch of snowflakes.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing. I never encountered them in my classes, but Phil did.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Huh.
I never encountered them in history or the filmmaking courses I took. But since Phil was
because... The history and filmmaking courses would have touched on the ugly side of history and filmmaking also, and that would have offended the sensibilities of, you know, people who aren't ready for stuff like that.
Right.
The
Phil was taking a lot of...
signed up for those classes would have been ready for those things and understood that things in our past stay in our past, And that's what happened. Instead of trying to edit all old movies and...
Well, he took a lot of sociology and anthropology courses, so he encountered them.
Or making, you know, like... Like someone did something 10 years ago on Facebook or whatever, doesn't mean that they need to be fired today. You know what I mean?
Right.
The cancel culture, or whatever they call it.
In the autumn of 1773, he entered King's College, which is now Columbia, and he became a full member in 1774. Now, it was in college where he met his lifelong friend, Robert Troup, who spoke highly of Hamilton, defending the Patriots' cause in his first public speaking appearance on July 6, 1774, at the Liberty Pole. I learned about these at the Museum of the American Revolution.
I watched this, the thing about Alexander and Burr. On the duel? What was it? Comedy Central. The Drunk History.
Yeah,
and they were basically saying the difference between the two is that Alexander Hamilton went through life, like, starting shit with everybody.
Yeah.
And Aaron Burr was the one that was quiet and calculating. And then at the end of life, they switch positions.
Oh, yeah, we'll get into that.
And, yeah, that's...
Well, and also...
At the very end, Alexander Hamilton was quiet and composed and thinking about what he was doing, and Burr wasn't, which is what...
Yeah, the Liberty Pole, what I learned...
Led to what happened.
See, we had two different things that we would gather around in villages... To talk about the politics of the day. There was a Liberty Pole where they would take a hat and stick it on the end of a pole and stick the pole up so people would be like, oh, the pole's up, let's go talk. And then they would also meet around like a big tree called the Liberty Tree.
Yeah.
I learned about those at the Museum of the American Revolution.
Be like today's water cooler.
Right. And... I can understand the tree because, you know, you had shade under it.
Well, a little different than the water cooler. Right. You know what I mean?
Right. And just recently, like within this century, the last known Liberty Tree fell in Annapolis, Maryland. Because they have a fake one set up that people can see in the museum.
Why did it fall? Did it, like, old. Because of weather or something?
The weather came in and it was old and the roots couldn't support it anymore.
You think they would have had, like, the best, like, tree doctor around to, like, keep it healthy.
I don't know, but they took... Basically, what Annapolis did is when they cut it, they took a section of it and donated it to the Museum of the American Revolution.
Yeah.
So that when you see their Liberty Tree in this section that's supposed to be a knot hole, there's the piece from the Annapolis tree.
I wonder how many rings it had.
Oh, they showed pictures of it. This thing was huge.
Yeah, I bet.
That's what she said.
I wonder how many like years it was like growing, you know what I mean?
Right.
Because every ring is like...
A year.
Yeah. Or a season, anyway.
Yeah.
Like a summer. You know, because in the winter, it doesn't grow. Right? Right. In the summer, it grows. But basically, yeah, a year.
Now, the Church of England clergyman, Samuel Seabury... published a series of pamphlets promoting the Loyalist cause in 1774, to which Hamilton responded anonymously with his first political writings, a full vindication of the measures of Congress and the farmer refuted. That's a long-ass title. Now, Seabury essentially tried to provoke fear in the colonies, and his main objective was to stop the potential union among the colonies. Hamilton published two additional pieces attacking the Quebec Act and may have also authored the 15 anonymous installments of The Monitor for Holt's New York Journal. Hamilton was a supporter of the revolutionary cause at this pre-war stage, and although he did not approve of mob reprisals against the Loyalists, on May 10, 1775, he won credit for saying his college president, Miles Cooper, a Loyalist, he saved him from an angry mob by speaking to the crowd long enough for Cooper to escape. Don't worry, buddy, I got you. Hey, have you seen that ankle on that girl today? Woohoo!
Them ankles, boy. Woo wee!
So Hamilton was forced to discontinue his studies before graduating when the college closed its door during the British occupation of the city. When the war ended, after some months of self-study, by July of 1782, he passed the bar exam, and in October of 1782, was licensed to argue cases before the Supreme Court of the state of New York. In 1775, after the first engagement of American troops with the British at Lexington and Concord, Hamilton and other King's College students joined a New York volunteer militia company called the Corsicans, and they later renamed or reformed as the Hearts of Oak. Such cool names for, you know, militia units.
Yeah, sure.
We are the Corsicans. Makes it sound like, you know, they're going out to the bars after the war, and, you know, come here, you wench.
Yeah.
So he drilled with the company before classes in the graveyard of the nearby St. Paul's Chapel. Hamilton studied military history and tactics on his own and was soon recommended for promotion. Now, under fire from the HMS Asia, he led a successful raid for British cannons in the Battery, then the capture of which resulted in the Hearts of Oak becoming an artillery company thereafter. And Hamilton was, at this point in the war, he was an artillerist. Well, I also picked
that up. I was waiting for you to continue.
Yeah, I also picked that up at the Museum of the American Revolution because they had an exhibit of Hamilton going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, he was, well, I have to say, Monica's son, for being 5 years old, because the cannon crews in those days were like 15 guys.
Yeah.
James did everything in 15 seconds that all 15 guys would have done.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He did everything from, like, cleaning the cannon to loading it to priming it. Everything.
Huh.
I looked at him and said, you know, I'd like to have you as a cannon crew. I'd put a couple guys to guard you, but you got it down.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing he couldn't do was pick up the cannonballs and load them in.
Yeah.
Everything else he could do. Had that down to 15 seconds. I timed him.
Huh.
Now, through his connections with the influential New York...
So what, they just had a cannon there you could mess with?
Yeah, they had it down in, like, the... Well, it was on the main floor of the museum. Because when you go into the museum on the main floor, they've got, like, you know, where you could, you know, buy your tickets. They got, like, a cafe a cafe, and then the gift shop.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a room for kids.
Yeah.
And they had a cannon set up, and they would show the kids, okay, well, this is step one, this is step two. They would take the kids...
All the way down to, like, putting the primer in and
putting
everything.
The primer and firing. It was a 15-step process.
Hmm.
And James could do it in 15 seconds.
No shit. That's pretty badass for, like...
A five-year-old.
Yeah! For, like... I'm, like, 15 seconds. I'm sitting there thinking, I'm, like, you know, like, how the hell did they, you know, and...
Well, and they had two ramrods, one that they would put down the clean after the firing.
Yeah, and they'll put out any...
Yeah.
And then, you know... Because it was wet, because you'd want to put out any embers that were down there,
mm-hmm.
just in case, because when you went to go load that load,
If there was still a charge in there.
If there was still an ember in there, it would ignite that, right. your new load.
And I mean, it was a room off to the side. You know, it was
your
for the kids.
Wouldn't fit the same way after that.
And you know, the kids got to learn about how to fire a cannon, and got to dress up in the period costumes and everything. But James had, you know, he was more involved with the cannon. He didn't want to look at all the other stuff.
Mm.
He wanted to play with the cannon.
Hell yeah.
5 years old, and he was doing artillery, and I'm like, well, hell. I mean, Monica and I went and looked at the rest of the museum, because I wanted to see the Hamilton exhibit.
And, yeah, James is all rolling the fucking cannon out to the car.
Yeah, well, he would have had to get past his grandma on that one.
My grandma got it hooked up to the car. Let's roll home.
Right. Bring this baby home!
Hey, can we stop and get some black powder on the way up at Walmart?
Get some black powder and some cannonballs.
Well, he probably would have taken some cannonballs.
Okay, so through his connections with the influential New York patriots such as Alexander McDougall and John Jay, Hamilton raised the New York Provincial Company of Artillery of 60 men in 1776 and was elected their captain. Now, the company took part in the campaign of 1776 around New York City, particularly at the Battle of White Plains. At the Battle of Trenton, he was stationed at the high point of town, the meeting of the present Warren and Broad Streets, to keep the Hessians pinned in the Trenton barracks. Damn Germans.
Damn Hessians. Oh, jeez.
So Hamilton participated in the Battle of Princeton on January 3rd, 1777. After an initial setback, Washington rallied the American troops and led them in a successful charge against the British forces. After making a brief stand, the British fell back, some leaving Princeton and others taking up refuge in Nassau Hall. Hamilton brought three cannons up and had them fire upon the building.
You know, what was it, I don't know, like 10 years ago or something like that, when I went with my, I was trying to get my license, but my CDL license back, I think it was 10 years ago or something like that. I can't remember, I think it was 08 or 09, I can't remember. Well, anyway, I went with my cousin riding in the truck to make sure I still had the skills to pay the bills. And we went to New Haven, Connecticut, and we passed by the exit for Sleepy Hollow.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So when you said Hessians, I was all like, oh, the headless horseman. I was Sleepy Hollow, and then I'm like, oh, yeah.
The headless horseman.
And you said White Plains, New York.
Yeah.
So that, you know... I was like, that's kind of, you know, I was like, oh, maybe I'll just tell them that little tidbit.
So,
but yeah, Sleepy Hollow, that's pretty sweet. I wish I could have, like, stopped and, like, went around there.
Oh, yeah, I want to go. I think I told Monica that I'd like to go out there one day, Sleepy Hollow.
Hell yeah.
I'd like to go to Salem, too.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so he brought up the cannons. Now, some Americans rushed the front door, and they broke it down. Well, the British subsequently put a white flag outside one of the windows. Hey! Don't fire!
I have been to Salem, Oregon, but I've never been to Salem, Massachusetts. A little funny story about Salem, Oregon. This is the first time I was training with my cousin back in 1999. We stopped at a Chinese restaurant because we hadn't eaten. We bobtailed down there.
You know,
we left the trailer at the... at the warehouse. We went down there and we're sitting at a Chinese restaurant eating, and my little waitress is like, you know, we're flirting with her and stuff and eating our food, and we're all like, so how long you been working here, whatever, you know, and we're like, how old are you? And she's like, oh, actually it's my 21st birthday tonight, and my twin sister and me are going out on the town. And then we were all like, hell yeah. I was like, too bad we had to, like, get loaded and be in Texas, like, the next night or something like that. So we were like, man, I wish we had another day to, like, spend in Oregon, because we would totally take these trips out. Oh, hell yeah. Twin sisters? Fuck yeah. Me and my cousin were, like, down to party. But, man, we couldn't, you know, we couldn't. So I just wish. One of those regrets.
Right. So
I'd have been like, oh, the car. I'd be like, the semi's got three flat tires.
So the British waved a white flag, and 194 British soldiers walked out of the building and laid down their arms.
Oh, wow.
Thus ending the battle in an American victory.
I guess.
Fellas, they're going to fire a cannon. Fuck! Surrender!
Yeah.
We're done! Hamilton was invited to become an aide to William Alexander, Lord Stirling, and one other general, perhaps Nathan Greene or Alexander McDougall. Now, he declined these invitations, believing his best chance for improving his situation in life was glory on the battlefield. Now, he eventually received an invitation he felt he could not refuse.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he served as Washington's aide.
Oh.
With the rank of Lieutenant Colonel.
Wow.
Hey, when George Washington calls you to be an aide, you fucking take the offer.
Well, yeah. We couldn't really call him because no phones.
Well, right. But, you know, when you receive the letter that George Washington wants you...
when he writes you a letter...
I'd be like, see ya! Yeah, I'm going to the big, big time. I'm on my way. I'm making it. Now, Washington felt... aide-de-camps are persons...
wonder if your dad got the app... the, I wonder if he got the call from Bill Clinton. Like the imaginary call.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
That's for you out there.
Oh, I am sure that man got the imaginary phone call.
That's for the people who love Scott's dad.
He got it on the crazy phone. Yeah. Meet... Yes, President. I want to tell you, I got some hotties here that I need people distracted from. I'm on it. Okay, Washington said that aide-de-camps are persons in whom entire confidence must be placed, and it requires men of abilities to execute the duties with property and dispatch. Hamilton served for 4 years as Washington's chief staff aide. He handed letters to Congress, state governors, and the most powerful generals in the Continental Army. He drafted many of Washington's orders and letters at Washington's discretion. He eventually issued orders from Washington over Hamilton's own signature. Hamilton was involved in a wide variety of high-level duties, including intelligence, diplomacy, and negotiations with senior army officers as Washington's emissary. I bet he'd been like, hey, when I speak, Washington speaks. And I have the authority to bitch slap you.
Yeah. Respect my fucking authority.
Alexander Hamilton, the first person to say respect my authority. I could just see Eric Cartman dressed like Hamilton. Respect my authority! Now, during the war, Hamilton became close friends with several fellow officers. His letters to the Marquis de Lafayette and to John Laurens, employing the sentimental literary conventions of the late 18th century and alluding to Greek history and mythology, have been read by Jonathan Ned Katz as revealing a homosocial or perhaps homosexual relationship.
Homosexual.
Yeah. Oh. On the other hand, biographer Gregory D. Massey dismisses all speculations on a Laurens-Hamilton relationship as unsubstantiated, describing their friendship as purely platonic camaraderie and placing their correspondence in the context of the flowery diction of the time.
Hmm.
So there was no rump rangering going on.
Too bad.
It made the musical a lot better.
Yeah.
So while he was stationed in Morristown, New Jersey, in the winter of 1779 to 1780, he met Elizabeth Schuyler, daughter of General Philip Schuyler and Catherine Van Rensselaer. The two were married on December 14th, 1780, at the Schuyler Mansion in Albany, New York. I think that place still stands.
Probably.
I think it does because Washington used it as a headquarters. Now, Elizabeth and Alexander had 8 kids.
Damn.
Though there's often confusion because 2 of the sons were named Philip.
I guess Philip with a PH and Philip with an F.
Nope. So there was Philip in 1782. Philip died in a duel.
Because
it was in the exact same place with the exact same guns that Dad would use. Yeah.
Yep.
Then there was their daughter, Angelica, Alexander Jr., James Alexander, John Church, William Stephen, Eliza, and Philip, who was called Little Phil, named after his older brother who had been killed in a duel the previous year. Now, what's funny is one of Hamilton's grandsons rode with Custer at the Battle of the Washita.
Hmm.
And he was shot with a bullet.
Hmm.
He was the first one killed in the battle.
Oh, shit.
I was like, what's it with this family and bullets?
No shit.
Now, after his death in 1804, Elizabeth endeavored to preserve his legacy. She reorganized all of his letters, papers, and writings with the help of her son, John Church. And preserved through many setbacks in getting his biography published. She was so devoted to his memory that she wore a small package around her neck containing the pieces of a sonnet which he wrote to her during the early days of their courtship.
Hmm.
Now, this Hamilton exhibit that I saw, there were some family heirlooms in there, like his great-great-great-grandson brought him in.
Yeah.
And one was a ring that Elizabeth wore, was called a mourning ring,
mm-hmm.
that actually had some strands of Alexander Hamilton's hair in it.
Huh.
I'm like, can we crack this open and run some DNA? Can we clone this motherfucker again? I'm running around the museum trying to get DNA of the founding fathers, you know. Let's bring these bastards back!
Trying to combine them like some
Serpentor fucker.
Yeah, some Serpentor Frankenstein type experiment.
Well, you know, I am bored down there in the basement, and you know,
it's alive.
I did watch Frankenstein on Halloween. So Hamilton was also close friends to her sisters. Now, during his lifetime, he was even rumored to have an affair with his wife's older sister, Angelica, who, 3 years before the marriage to Elizabeth, had eloped with John Barker Church, an Englishman who made a fortune in North America during the war, and later returned to Europe with his wife and children between 1783 and 1797.
Hmm.
Now, even though the style of their correspondence during her 14-year residence in Europe was flirtatious, modern historians like Chernow and Fielding agree that despite contemporary gossip, there's no conclusive evidence that they had a physical relationship.
Not even a one-night stand.
Now, Hamilton also maintained a correspondence with her younger sister, Margarita, who was nicknamed Peggy, who was the recipient of his first letters praising her sister at the time of his courtship in early 1780.
Margarita?
Now, while he was on Washington's staff, he long sought command and a return to active combat. As the war drew nearer to an end, he knew that opportunities for military glory were diminishing. On February 15th, 1781, he was reprimanded by Washington after a minor misunderstanding. Although Washington quickly tried to mend the relationship, Hamilton insisted on leaving his staff. He officially left in March and settled with Eliza close to Washington's headquarters. He repeatedly asked Washington and others for a field command. Now, Washington demurred, citing the need to appoint men of higher rank. This continued until early July of 1781, when he submitted a letter to Washington with his commission enclosed, thus tactfully threatening to resign if he didn't get his desired command. Give me what I want or I fucking quit.
Yeah, he was. I heard he was a real jerk when it come to, like...
Yeah.
He, like, was not quiet about anything. He, like...
No.
He had the littlest bit of problem. He was... Yeah, just...
So on July 31st, Washington relented and assigned Hamilton as a commander of a battalion of light infantry companies of the 1st and 2nd New York Regiments, and two provisional companies from Connecticut. In the planning for the assault on Yorktown, he was given command of three battalions, which were to fight in conjunction with the Allied French troops and take in redoubts number 9 and 10, of the British fortifications at Yorktown. Well, Hamilton and his battalions fought bravely and took Redoubt Number 10 with bayonets in a nighttime action as planned. The French also fought bravely for cheese-eating surrender monkeys, and they suffered heavy casualties and took Redoubt Number 9. These actions forced the British to surrender of an entire army at Yorktown, Virginia, marking the de facto end of the war. Although small battles continued for two more years until the signing of the Treaty of Paris and the departure of the last British troops. Bonjour! Got cheese eating surrender monkeys? Now, in 1787, he was one of the delegates from New York to the Constitutional Convention. His involvement was limited as his two other delegates opposed his ideas for a strong national government, making sure that their votes did not alter the Articles of Confederation. Hamilton proposed having a president for life, but no one listened to him. And thank God no one listened. Because we'd have that problem right now.
Oh, shit.
He also proposed to have senators elected for life, only being removed based on corruption or abuse, but this made him look like a monarchist sympathizer by James Madison. Hamilton also argued for the rich and well-born to run the government, but this isolated him from the rest of the delegates. In his notes on the convention, Madison quoted Hamilton as saying about the executive, and I'm going the wrong way here, Madison is quoted as saying, "The English model was the only good one on this subject. The hereditary interest of the king was so interwoven with that of the nation, and his personal emolument so great that he was placed above the danger of being corrupted from abroad. Let one executive be appointed for life who dares execute his powers." Hamilton argued, "And let me observe that an executive is less dangerous to the liberties of the people when in office during life than for 7 years. It may be said this constitutes as an elective monarchy, but by making the executive subject to impeachment, the term monarchy cannot apply." So Hamilton wrote his own draft of the Constitution, but he didn't present it to the delegation. This draft had most of the features of the actual Constitution. Now, in his draft, the Senate was to be elected in proportion to the population, being 2/5 the size of the House, and the President and Senators were to be elected through a complex multi-stage elections in which chosen electors would elect smaller bodies of electors that would hold office for life but were removable for misconduct. The president would have absolute veto. The Supreme Court was to have immediate jurisdiction over all lawsuits involving the United States, and state governors were to be appointed by the federal government. Damn, Alex!
No shit.
Well, with the actual Constitution, he was not pleased with it, but he signed it anyway. "I hate this piece of paper, but fuck you all, I'm signing it." Bam. He is the only New York delegate to sign it since the other two withdrew. See, the other two wanted to keep him silent, but they're like, "Oh, fuck it, we're done. Someone else can deal with him." Now, to help, Hamilton enlisted John Jay and James Madison to write a series of articles to support the Constitution, which became known as the Federalist Papers. Hamilton wrote the majority of the essays, 51 of them.
Jesus.
While Madison wrote 29 and Jay only wrote 5. Wait for picking up the slack there, Jay. I guess we can't trouble you to do some fucking work around here.
5.
Yeah. Now, Hamilton supervised the entire project, enlisted the participants who wrote the majority of the essays, and oversaw the publication. Now, during the project, each person was responsible for their areas of expertise. Jay covered foreign relations. Madison covered the history of republics and confederacies, along with the anatomy of the new government. And Hamilton covered the branches of government most pertinent to him, the executive and judicial, with some aspects to the Senate, as well as covering military matters and taxation. The papers first appeared in the Independent Journal on October 27, 1787. Now, Hamilton wrote the first paper, and he signed it under the pseudonym Plubius.
Well,
these guys were all into the classic Greek and Roman, so they would take on these pseudonyms. Except John Jay. He signed his name. I've read some of the Federalist Papers.
Yeah.
And you can tell, Jay writes, signs his Jay. Well, gee. Just let us know who's writing the fucking paper.
Well, yeah, because he only wrote five, so he wants to get credit for the five at least. He don't want there to be any muddy waters between the five that he wrote.
And all of the subsequent papers were signed under the name Plubius. Jay wrote the next four papers to elaborate on the Confederation's weakness and the need for unity against foreign aggression and against splitting into rival confederacies, and, except for number 64, was not further involved. I am done! Now, Hamilton's highlights included discussion that although republics had been culpable for disorders in the past, advances in the science and politics had fostered principles that ensured that those abuses could be prevented, such as the division of power, legislative checks and balances, independent judiciaries, and legislatures that were represented by electors, which, for those of you who have read the Federalist Papers, those are numbers 7 through 9. Hamilton also wrote an extensive defense of the Constitution, numbers 23 through 36, and discussed the Senate and executive and judicial branches in numbers 65 through 85. Hamilton and Madison worked to describe the anarchic state of the Confederation in numbers 15 through 22, and having been described as not being entirely different in thought during this time period, in contrast to the stark opposition later in life. Subtle differences appear with the two when discussing the necessity of a standing army. So, Washington was elected the first president.
Yes.
As we were all told in school. He made Hamilton our very first Secretary of the Treasury.
Yes.
Which is why he's on the $10 bill.
Roger.
Hamilton began working and in 1790 wrote the report on public credit. In the report, Hamilton felt that the securities should be paid in full value to their legitimate owners, including those who took the financial risk of buying government bonds that most experts thought would never be redeemed. Hi, we're going to sell these, but they're not going to... Yeah, they'll never be redeemed.
May not be able to redeem the money on them.
What? Huh? He argued that liberty and property security were inseparable and that the government should honor the contracts as they form the basis of public and private morality.
And trust.
To Hamilton, the proper handling of the government debt would also allow America to borrow at affordable interest rates and would also be a stimulant to the economy.
Yep.
Now, Hamilton divided the national debt into national and state debt, and further divided the national debt into foreign and domestic. While there was an agreement on how to handle the foreign debt, especially with France, there was not with regards to the national debt held by domestic creditors. Now, during the war, affluent citizens had invested in bonds, and war veterans had been paid with promissory notes and IOUs that plummeted in price during the Confederation. The old promissory note. But the old man was in the background going, So in response to all of this, the war veteran sold the securities to speculators for as little as 15 to 20 cents on the dollar.
To get something out of...
Right.
Rather get something than nothing, you know?
Hamilton felt the money from the bonds should not go to the soldiers, but the speculators who had bought the bonds from the soldiers, who had shown little faith in the country's future.
Bullshit. The money should go to the fucking soldiers.
Well, the guys who fought...
the ones who fought and bled for this motherfucker anyway.
The process of attempting to track down the original bondholders, along with the government showing discrimination among the classes of holders, if the war veterans were to be compensated, also weighed in as factors for Hamilton. As for state debts, Hamilton suggested to consolidate it with the national debt and label it as a federal debt for the sake of efficiency on the national scale. Now, the last portion of the report dealt with eliminating the debt by utilizing a sinking fund that would retire 5% of the debt annually until it was paid off. Now, due to the bonds being traded well below their face value, the purchases would benefit the government as the securities rose in price. When the report was submitted to the House of Representatives, detractors soon began to speak against it. Some of the negative views expressed in the House were that the notion of programs that resembled British practice were wicked, and that the balance of power would be shifted away from the representatives to the executive branch. William Macaulay suspected that several congressmen were involved in government securities, seeing Congress in an unholy league with New York speculators.
That's where
it all begins.
No wonder why it's all fucked up and crooked as hell these days. It started off crooked.
Yeah.
You see how he was saying, oh, we're not going to call it this, we're going to call it that, and then we're just not going to fucking pay it. It's like, dude! Like, I can't do that with my bills. Why the fuck should we do that with ours? You know, the country.
Well, so Congressman James Jackson also spoke against New York with allegations of speculators attempting to swindle those who had not yet heard about Hamilton's report. Now, the only report, or the only account of what happens next, comes from Thomas Jefferson.
Well, let's see what he has to say.
Now, Jefferson met Hamilton outside Washington's office in June of 1790. Now, this is when the Capitol was in New York City. Because we were trying to decide where to put the Capitol. For a while it was Philadelphia, for a while it was New York. Now, Jefferson stated that Hamilton looked ragged and asked what he could do. Hamilton had a plan for an assumption bill where the federal government would take on the state debts from the war. The only problem was Madison was holding up the vote. So this was Jefferson's idea. He offered to have a dinner party with just the two of them so they could hash out this deal. So, all three met at Jefferson's house to discuss this bill. And as we know, Madison was opposed to it since Virginia had paid off most of her debt already. Madison did not think the government should take this on since he figured out how much was still owed. Now, the debt was $77 million, with $11.7 going to foreign, $40.4 to domestic, and $25 million was state. They had to calculate all that shit. Pretty good. Madison would get his supporters to agree on this to one condition. If Hamilton could convince his supporters to vote on moving the capital to a southern state. Now, Hamilton and his supporters were pushing for New York to be the capital. Because Hamilton had this idea that with New York as the capital, it'd be like the financial and fashion capital to the country, mm-hmm. and that it was easier access for like people from Britain and France and Europe to come
Which
in.
Which it is anyway.
Oh, right.
But it's not the capital, but it's
the center.
It's basically the economic center of the country.
Now, but he also wanted it to be in the model of Paris.
Yeah.
You know, cultural and financial and all this stuff. Now, both men wanted their respective supporter Now, they both went to their respective supporters, and within a couple of weeks, the government took on the Assumptions Bill, and the Capitol was moved to the border of Virginia and Maryland, where it sits today. So Madison was like, hey, we agree to Hamilton shit, we can get the Capitol in a southern state.
Fuck that.
Well, I guess it was a fair enough trade for everybody. So in the summer of 1797, Hamilton became the first major American politician publicly involved in a sex scandal.
Oh, shit. Here we go.
6 years earlier, in the summer of 1791, Hamilton was 34 and he started an affair with 23-year-old Maria Reynolds. According to Hamilton's recount, Maria approached him at his house in Philadelphia, claiming that her husband, James, had abandoned her and she wished to return to her relatives in New York, but lacked the means. Well, Hamilton got her address, and he delivered her $30 personally at her boarding house, where she led him into her bedroom, and
thanked him for the $30.
Some conversation ensued from which it was quickly apparent that other than pecuniary consolation would be acceptable. Listen here, ho. The two began an intermittent illicit affair that lasted approximately until June of 1792. Over the course of that year, while the affair took place, James Reynolds was well aware of his wife's unfaithfulness.
Who you fucking hoe?
Right. He continually supported the relationship to regularly gain blackmail money from Hamilton. It was probably one of these where he's sitting there at dinner and going, like, okay, who are you fucking?
Yeah.
I'm fucking Alexander Hamilton.
Well, that's me.
You know what? How do you keep fucking him? As long as we can get some money out of it. I don't mind retting your pussy out.
Yeah.
The common practice in the day was for the wronged husband to seek retribution in a pistol duel. But Reynolds, realizing how much Hamilton had to lose if his activity came to public view, insisted on monetary compensation instead. So after an initial request of $1,000, to which Hamilton replied, Reynolds invited Hamilton to renew his visits to his wife as a friend.
Oh, yeah, she's my friend.
Oh, baby, you got what I need. But you say he's just a friend.
Yeah.
Only to exhort forced loans after each visit that the most likely colluding Maria solicited with her letters. Now, in the end, the blackmail payments totaled over $1,300, which included the initial extortion.
Which isn't really shit.
Well, back then it was.
Well, yeah.
Now, Hamilton at this point was possibly aware of both the Reynoldses being involved in the blackmail. And welcomed.
What year was it? 1792. Alexa, what is $1,300 from 1792 in today's money?
Sorry, I'm not sure about that.
She's dumb sometimes.
So he welcomed as well as strictly complied with the request to end the affair. He was like, hey, I'll end it, okay? You got my word on it. Giggity giggity.
Yeah.
So in November of 1792, Reynolds and his associate Jacob Klingman were arrested for counterfeiting and speculating in veteran back wages.
Hmm.
Dude, can you imagine counterfeiting money back in the 1790s? How labor intensive that was?
Yeah, no shit.
Now, Klingman was released on bail and relayed information to James Monroe that Reynolds had evidence that would incriminate Hamilton. Monroe consulted with Congressman Muhlenberg and Venerable on what actions to take, and the congressman confronted Hamilton on December 15, 1792. Now, Hamilton refuted the suspicions of speculation by exposing his affair with Maria and producing as evidence the letters by both Reynolds, proving that his payments to James related to blackmail over his adultery and not to the Treasury misconduct.
$34,000 in today's money.
Okay.
So, yeah, it'd be like, you gonna fuck my wife? I want $35,000.
Okay, so the trio were kept.
You can't even get a Chevy pickup with that.
Not even a good one.
Well, you could put a good... You would still owe like $5,000 or $10,000, depending on the package.
Right. Okay, the trio were to keep the documents privately with the utmost confidence. Now, in the summer of 1797, however, when notoriously scurrilous journalist James T. Callender, and this guy is such a work, I might have to look him up.
James T. what?
Callender.
Callender.
I think he was, in the election of 1800,
mm-hmm.
Jefferson hired him to write damning pieces about John Adams in a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
But then Callender, I think, didn't get... He got paid from Jefferson, but he didn't get paid what he thought he should have. So then he exposed that Jefferson was sleeping with his slave, Sally Hemings.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So Callender published a piece called A History of the United States for the Year 1796, and it contained accusations of James Reynolds being an agent of Hamilton, using documents from the confrontation of December 15, 1792. On July 5, 1797, Hamilton wrote to Monroe, Muhlenberg, and Venerable, asking them to confirm that there was nothing that would damage the perception of his integrity while as Secretary of the Treasury. All complied with Hamilton's request except James Monroe. Hamilton then published a 100-page booklet, later usually referred to as the Reynolds pamphlet, and discussed the affair in exquisite detail. Hamilton's wife, Elizabeth, eventually forgave him, but not James Monroe. Although he faced ridicule from the Democratic-Republican faction, he maintained his availability for public service. Now, during the military buildup of the Quasi-War of 1789 and 1800, and with the strong endorsement of Washington, who had been called out of retirement to lead the army, should the French invade, Adams reluctantly appointed Hamilton a major general of the army. At Washington's insistence, Hamilton was made the senior major general, prompting Henry Knox to decline appointment to serve as Hamilton's junior. Because Knox had served as a major general, and he thought that serving under Hamilton was beneath him.
Yeah.
You know, military rank, you know. So Hamilton served as an Inspector General of the United States Army from July 18, 1798 to June 15, 1800. Because Washington was unwilling to leave Mount Vernon unless it was to command an army in the field, Hamilton was the de facto head of the army to Adams' considerable displeasure.
Hmm.
Oh, Thomas Jefferson hated Hamilton too.
Oh, I bet.
If full-scale war broke out with France, Hamilton argued that the army should conquer the North American colonies of France's ally Spain, bordering the United States. Hamilton was prepared to march his army through the southern United States if necessary, possibly also using his army in Virginia to quash opposition to Adams and himself. To To fund this army, Hamilton wrote regularly to Oliver Wolcott Jr., his successor at the Treasury, William Lawton Smith of the House Ways and Means Committee, and Senator Theodore Sedgwick of Massachusetts. He directed them to pass a direct tax to fund the war. While Smith resigned in 1797 as Hamilton scolded him for slowness. Come on, fucker, I need the money! And told Wolcott to tax houses instead of land. The eventual program included a stamp act like that of the British before the Revolution, and other taxes on land, houses, and slaves, calculated at different rates in different states, requiring difficult and intricate assessments of houses. Well, this provoked resistance from southeastern Pennsylvania, led primarily by men such as John Fries, who had marched with Washington against the Whiskey Rebellion. The Whiskey Rebellion, the only rebellion besides Prohibition against booze.
Yeah, or shit.
So Hamilton aided in all areas of the Army's development, and after Washington's death, he was by default the senior officer of the United States Army from December 14th, 1799 to June 15th, 1800. The Army was to guard against invasion from France. John Adams, however, derailed all plans for war by opening negotiations with France that led to peace. Since there was no longer a need for the army, Hamilton was running. So the army kind of went away. Adams discovered that the key cabinet members were more loyal to Hamilton rather than to the president. So he fired several of them, including Timothy Pickering.
Oh, well, shit.
In the 1800 election, Hamilton worked to defeat not only the rival Democratic-Republican candidates, but also his party's own nominee, John Adams. He was the fuck-it-all party.
Yeah, no shit.
Fuck it all, I'm done. So in November of 1799, the Alien and Sedition Acts had left one Democratic-Republican newspaper functioning in New York City. And when the last, the Daily Advertiser, reprinted an article saying that Hamilton had attempted to purchase the Philadelphia Aurora and close it down, Hamilton had the publisher prosecuted for seditious libel, and the prosecution compelled the owner to close the paper.
Well, hell.
You talking shit about my man here? Close your paper down. Now, Aaron Burr had won New York for Jefferson in May. Now, Hamilton proposed a rerun of the election under different rules, with the carefully drawn districts and each choosing an election or an elector, such that the Federalists would split the electoral vote of New York. Now, John Jay, who was a Federalist, had given up the Supreme Court to be governor of New York. He wrote on the back of the letter the words, "Proposing a measure for party purposes which it would not become me to adopt," and he declined to reply. He just said, fuck it. So Adams was running this time with Charles Cotesworth, John Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina. Hamilton now toured New England again, urging northern electors to hold firm for Pinckney in the renewed hope of making Pinckney president. And he again intrigued in South Carolina. Hamilton's aides involved coaxing middle state Federalists to assert their non-support for Adams if there was no support for Pinckney, and writing to more of the modest supporters of Adams concerning his supposed misconduct while president. Hamilton expected to see southern states such as the Carolinas cast their vote for Pinckney and Jefferson, and would result in the former being ahead of both Adams and Jefferson. So in accordance with the plans and a recent personal rift with Adams, Hamilton wrote a pamphlet called A Letter from Alexander Hamilton Concerning the Public Conduct and Character of John Adams, Esquire, President of the United States, that was highly critical of him, though it closed with a tepid endorsement. You know, he's a bitch-ass punk, he sucks his thumb. He's a mama's boy, but he's the best we got.
Yeah.
He mailed this to 200 leading Federalists, and when a copy fell into the Democratic Republicans' hands, they printed it.
Oh, shit.
So this hurt Adams' 1800 re-election campaign and split the party, virtually assuring the victory of the Democratic Republican Party, which was led by Jefferson in the election. It destroyed Hamilton's position among the Federalists. Now, Jefferson had beaten Adams, but both he and his running mate, Aaron Burr, had received 73 votes in the Electoral College. So with Jefferson and Burr tied, the United States House of Representatives had to choose between the two men, which happens if there's a tie.
Yeah.
Now, several Federalists who opposed Jefferson supported Burr, and for the first 35 ballots, Jefferson was denied a majority. But before the 36th ballot, Hamilton threw his support behind Jefferson, supporting the arraignment reached by James Bayard of Delaware, in which five Federalist representatives from Maryland and Vermont abstained from voting, allowing these states' delegations to go for Jefferson, which ending the impasse, and elected Jefferson president rather than Aaron Burr. Or Burr.
Yeah. Aaron Burr.
Aaron.
Yeah.
You done messed up, Aaron. Now, even though Hamilton did not like Jefferson and disagreed with him on many issues, he viewed Jefferson as the lesser of two evils. Well, shit. Hamilton spoke of Jefferson as being by far not only a dangerous man, but that Burr was a mischievous enemy to the principal measures of the past administration. It was for that reason, along with the fact that Burr was a Northerner and not a Virginian, that many Federalist representatives voted for him. Now, Hamilton wrote an exceeding number of letters to friends in Congress to convince the members to see otherwise. The Federalists rejected Hamilton's diatribe as reasons to not vote for Burr. Nevertheless, Burr would become Vice President of the United States. When it became clear that Jefferson had developed his own concerns about Burr and would not support his return to the vice presidency, Burr sought the New York governorship in 1804 with Federalist support against Jeffersonian Morgan Lewis, but was defeated by forces including Hamilton. So soon after the 1804 gubernatorial election in New York, which we said Morgan Lewis won over Aaron Burr, the Albany Register published Charles D. Cooper's letters citing Hamilton's opposition to Burr and alleging that Hamilton had expressed a still more despicable opinion of the vice president at an upstate New York dinner party. Now, Cooper claimed that the letter was intercepted after relaying the information, but stated he was unusually cautious in recollecting the information from the dinner. While Burr, sensing an attack on his honor, "You have disgraced my honor," and recovering from his own defeat, he demanded an apology in letter form. Hamilton
demands satisfaction.
Right. "Sir, you have insulted my honor. I demand satisfaction." Fuck you. Hamilton wrote a letter in response and ultimately refused because he could not recall the instance of insulting Burr.
You know what? He insults so many people,
right, he's like, you know
on
what?
A daily basis that he can't remember that particular hosing.
Like, you know what? I insult so many fuckers daily. Which one were you again?
Yeah.
Hamilton would also have been accused of recanting Cooper's letter out of cowardice. Now, after a series of attempts to reconcile were to no avail, a duel was arranged through liaisons on June 17, 1804. The concept of honor was fundamental to Hamilton's vision of himself and the nation. Now, historians have noted as evidence of the importance that honor held in Hamilton's view that Hamilton had previously been a party to seven affairs of honor as a principal and to three as an advisor or second. Such affairs are often concluded prior to reaching their final stage, which is the duel.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you get your, you know, if you have a duel, you know, someone challenges you, I would act as your second, and then I would go meet with that guy second and be like, all right, here, let's work out a deal.
Mm-hmm.
We agree to this, if you agree to this, you know. And that's the job of the second. You know, to kind of
negotiate
all the shit before you all draw pistols. Now, before the duel, Hamilton wrote a defense of his decision to duel, while at the same time intending to throw away his shot, which was perfectly legal to do. Hamilton viewed his roles of being a father and a husband, putting his creditors at risk, placing his family's welfare in jeopardy, and his moral and religious stances as reasons not to duel. But he felt it impossible to avoid due to having made attacks on Burr, which he was unable to recant, and because of Burr's behavior prior to the duel. Now, he attempted to reconcile his moral and religious reasons and the codes of honor in politics. He intended to accept the duel in order to satisfy his morals and throw away his fire to satisfy his political codes. His desire to be available for future political matters also played a factor in his decision. Now, the duel began at dawn on July 11, 1804, along the west bank of the Hudson River on a rocky ledge in Weehawken, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Because motherfuckers shoot people all the time in New Jersey.
Oh, shit.
Watch an episode of The Sopranos.
Now they do. They didn't used to.
You know, watch an episode of The Sopranos and see how many people get whacked.
We're starting a tradition here.
Right. Now, coincidentally, the duel took place relatively close to the location of the duel that had ended the life of Hamilton's eldest son, Philip, 3 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go shoot near where my son shot. Because that's how we roll.
Yeah.
Now, after the seconds had measured the paces, Hamilton, according to William P. Van Ness and Burr, raised his pistol as if to try the light, and had to wear his glasses to prevent his vision from being obscured. Hamilton also refused the hairspring set of dueling pistols, which would need less pressure, offered by Nathaniel Pendleton.
Mm-hmm.
Vice President Aaron Burr shot Hamilton, delivering what proved to be a fatal wound. Hamilton's shot broke a tree branch directly above Burr's head. You could do. See, if you threw away your shot like that, you could still be considered as upholding honor.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of shot at the tree above, and you're like, okay, I shot at the tree, now your turn, and Burr's like, oh, hell no, fucker. BAM!
They probably shot at the same time.
Because
they probably went to shoot at the same time to shoot each other. And Burr was going to shoot him, and Hamilton probably just, like, aimed it in his direction, but clearly aimed away from him and shot the tree.
Well, see, nobody knew who fired first.
Yeah, oh,
That's how close the shots were.
Yeah.
Did Hamilton fire first? Did Burr fire first?
Did Greedo fire first, or did Han?
Right. So, but each side said that the other man fired first.
Mm-hmm.
So soon after, they measured and triangulated the shooting, but could not determine from which angle Hamilton had fired. Burr's shot hit Hamilton in the lower abdomen above the right hip. The bullet ricocheted off Hamilton's second or third false rib, fracturing it and causing considerable damage to his internal organs, particularly his liver and diaphragm.
Well, because if Burr shot first, that means that shot probably threw off Hamilton's shot, which maybe seems to think that Hamilton was actually trying to hit Burr.
Well, Hamilton had intended to throw away his shot.
That's what they say.
And even he said it in the letter. He's like,
he did it in the letter?
Yeah, he wrote in a letter that he was throwing away his shot. He's like, My code of honor demands that I do this.
Maybe if that, like, changed
No, he had no intention of hitting Burr. He was just going to shoot. He was going to basically shoot in a tree, which is what he did.
Mm-hmm.
But the bullet hit all that and became lodged in his first or second lumbar vertebrae.
Oh, wow.
So hitting like right down through here.
Yeah, bounced all around in there and then went to his vertebrae.
Yeah. Now, Ron Cherno considers the circumstances to indicate that after taking deliberate aim, Burr fired second, while the biographer James Ernest Cook suggests that Burr took careful aim and shot first, and Hamilton fired while falling after being struck by the bullet. Which could make sense. Because if you're bringing your gun like into the aiming position,
yeah,
and you have it still aimed up, and you get hit with the bullet, you're going to reflex.
Well, yeah, or if you're bringing it up and you get shot and you fall back,
yeah,
your arm goes up.
And you're going to reflex your shot, or yeah. reflex, your finger will tighten and you're going to fire off your bullet. Now, the paralyzed Hamilton, who knew himself to be mortally wounded, was ferried to the Greenwich Village home of his friend William Bayard Jr., who had been waiting on the dock. Sitting in the morning sun.
Or maybe when he got hit, he knew he was hit and he was falling backwards, and he made sure to shoot in the tree, and he pulled his trigger then. You never know.
You know what I think he said when he got shot? Motherfucker! I'd go back.
Yeah, but you'd still be all about...
Oh, right.
You'd still have your sensibilities.
Oh, yeah.
And he would still... You know, he probably got hit, so, you know, and you get getting shot, I'm sure you get hit so quick, you really don't feel
it. You don't realize what happens, right.
You know.
So after final visits from his family and friends and considerable suffering, Hamilton died at 2 o'clock the following afternoon, July 12th, 1804, at Bayard's home, which is now 8082 Jane Street. Governor Morris gave the eulogy at his funeral and secretly established a fund to support the widow and children. Hamilton was buried in the Trinity Churchyard Cemetery in Manhattan.
And since it was a duel, Aaron Burr didn't get in trouble.
Well, dueling was illegal, but that's why they went to New Jersey to do it. But right, he didn't get in trouble, and I always joke that he came into Congress the next day, put the gun up on his desk and was like, "Try me, motherfuckers. I already killed one man. I'll do it again." I did get to see the statues. The New York Museum loaned for the Hamilton exhibit at the Museum of the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Statues of Hamilton and Burr in their duel stances.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they were right there in the lobby. Hamilton stood like, you know, with his left profile facing the audience.
Yeah.
And Burr's statue had his back to the audience.
Yeah.
With, you know, his right arm extended. And they were measured off probably 10 paces in the lobby. Which, I mean, I thought was a cool touch.
Yep.
And that is the story of Alexander Hamilton.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Well, we're going to wrap this one up. If you're looking for us out there, we are officially on Anchor, the home of the Smartass Historian, all major podcasting apps, and Apple Podcasts. Brian, please do your job before I put a cap in your ass.
Yeah. Cap him with a old-ass fucking gun.
Flintlock pistol. And, join us on Facebook. Let us know how we're doing. Since we're also on Apple, please rate and review us so we know how good or bad we're doing.
Yeah.
And for the Smartass Historian, I'm Scotty J.
I'm Jeff.
Catch you later, folks.
Bye.